Come and Get It is the highly anticipated new novel from New York Times bestselling and award-winning author Kylie Reid. A fresh and provocative story about a college RA and her messy entanglement with a professor and three unruly students. Come and Get It is an intimate portrait of consumption, desire, and reckless abandon. Look for Come and Get It, available from Putnam, wherever books are sold.
The Book Review Podcast has been around for almost 14 years, and we would love to hear your feedback. Let us know what you think by joining our panel at nytimes.com/thebookreview. Thanks so much. This is the Book Review Podcast. I'm Pamela Paul, and this is our first time announcing our 10 best books of the year live in front of an audience, as well as to our listeners worldwide. Before we start to announce the books and talk about them, I want to introduce my panel here of fellow podcasters. Many of them will be familiar to those of you who listen regularly to the Book Review Podcast, but I'll tell you a little bit more about them. We have John Williams, who is an editor on the Books Desk. He edits all of our Daily Critics. He is also a writer for The Times. He writes the 5Qs column and many other things. And he is known for his great website of yore, The Second Pass. John, thanks for being here. Lauren Christensen is what we call a preview editor at The Book Review, one of a full staff, some of whom are here, but not all. Lauren joined us after stints at Vanity Fair and Harper's Bazaar, and she also has a master's from Oxford in Victorian literature. Greg Coles is our senior editor for books. He is also our poetry editor and a longtime veteran of The Book Review. Tina Jordan joined us recently after 28 years as the book's headmistress of Entertainment Weekly magazine. Emily Aiken, also new to the Book Review. She is another preview editor on our staff after previous stints as a reporter for the erstwhile Saturday Ideas section of the New York Times and at the New Yorker, an editor there. And Gall Beckerman is the author of When They Come for Us, We'll Be Gone, The Epic Struggle to Save Soviet Jewry. He is a former opinion editor of The Forward, and he is now a preview editor at The Book Review. Welcome, guys. We are going to announce painfully, one by one, our winners, beginning with fiction. And I am going to start with a third novel, The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. Greg, you want to tell us about it?
Sure. The Great Believers is an old-fashioned kind of sweeping social novel. It is set in two different time periods. One is the mid-80s in Chicago, where it tells the story of the early days of the AIDS crisis there. And it follows a group of gay men in Chicago, really at the cusp of big social change for gay men in general as a marginalized population dealing with this great crisis. And then the second part is set in basically present-day Paris, where one of the characters from the Chicago section, a woman who ends up taking care of a lot of those men, is now searching down her estranged daughter, who's been involved in a religious cult and has now moved to Paris. So that's it's a great book. It's written in the, kind of a sterling, almost journalistic, very clear prose, and it's very ambitious and almost flawless in what it pulls off.
And that, I think, points to what we mean by best books. So best books is a book that is not only of the moment, but a book that we think transcends the moment. When we choose these books and we agonize over this process, it takes us months. We actually begin at the very beginning of the calendar year. We're looking for books that combine not only excellent prose, strength of writing, but great storytelling, the force of the narrative, books that we think will really stand the test of time, whether they're fiction or nonfiction. And it was a pleasure to choose The Great Believers because it's a third novel. Now we know first novels are often recognized. Second novels now are with an official prize for them. But third novels, it's very nice to see people get recognized mid-career. And our next book on the list is another third novel. It's Washington Black by S.E. Adugin. And Emily is going to talk a little bit about that book.
Yes. So Washington Black is a work of historical fiction. It's set in the 1830s, primarily on our side of the globe. It opens in Barbados on a slave plantation. But despite that fact, it is not primarily a book about slavery. It's really an adventure story, and it's narrated by a young boy who is, he begins his life as a field hand on this plantation, but his life is utterly transformed. Within 50 pages, he's literally levitated out of slavery in a hot air balloon, and the novel takes off from there, and it goes to extraordinary places. It goes to the Arctic. It goes underwater. There's deep sea diving, all of which has been meticulously researched by Essie Adugin, and is just within the realms of possibility. So a rather implausible, but historically possible tale that's written in a supple, subtle, deeply nuanced prose. It's a tremendous work of imagination.
Those of you may have seen that Essie Adugin's novel recently won the Giller Prize in Canada for their best novel. And I should say that we picked these books actually almost 2 months ago. We sit tight as we watch the sort of fall literary prize season go by and see what else, what other recognition the novels get before they are recognized by us as one of our 10 best. The next novel is The Perfect Nanny. This is an unusual book in certain ways for us as a best book because it was released early in the year. So we do still look at books early in the year. It's one of three books on our fiction best list that is, but this one isn't quite a debut novel, but it was a debut as translated in the United States. So Leila Slimani's first novel, Adele, will be out in January in the US, but that was her first novel that she wrote, but this is the first one translated here. And it also came out not only early in the year in the US, but it also was published as a paperback original, which means that it didn't have a hardcover release, and sometimes those books don't get quite as much attention. But this one really knocked us out from the beginning. Leila Slimani herself is a really interesting figure. She was considered to be the Minister of Culture in France. She's of North African descent. I think she is an immigrant, French-Moroccan. And Lauren, tell us more about it.
I love this book so much. I think, you know, when I first looked at, you're looking at the cover, when I first saw it, it strikes you as this sort of commercial thriller. You don't see the head of the nanny, and I just kind of, you assume a lot of things from just the cover. And when you open it up, it just shocked me with the sort of psychological heft of it. It really dives deep into this story. It was based on a true story of a Brooklyn mother, I believe.
It was a Manhattan mother on the Upper West Side. Many of you probably remember this case where
a mother hired a nanny who ended up murdering the children. I'm not giving any spoilers. It's in the first sentence of this book. And so it was based on that story, and it sort of inverts the thriller structure because it starts with the climax, right? I mean, you know from the beginning that the nanny has killed the kids, and then somehow it gets even more dramatic from there, and I just thought that was such a brilliant construction. I also think that there's so much more than just the kind of emotional urgency of it. It's also it asks really hard questions that I think are so universal, even if you haven't experienced something as horrific as this, which are, what if a mother decides that she actually wants to continue having a life at the expense of spending some time with her young children? What are at stakes in the relationship between the mother and the person she trusts to, with the lives of her kids, and sort of other, outer world concerns of race and class that play into those really personal issues as well. So there's just so much to unpack in it, and it's a lot more than sort of just a cheap paperback.
it won the Prix Goncourt.
Yes,
it won the Prix Goncourt, which is France's top literary prize. And in French, it's interesting that it was published in a very different way. The title was Chanson Douce, which is
Lullaby.
And in England, it had a different title in London, too. It wasn't as commercial a title. I can't remember.
It's also a real portrait of mental illness, which is what I found fascinating, having been really struck by that news story here in New York. You want to understand how somebody could have kind of come to do something like this. And it's such a hard task for a novelist to set herself to actually kind of reverse engineer that, which is what the book does.
And I think what's fascinating, too, is she doesn't completely answer that question. Mm. I mean, we know this woman has snapped, and there are all sorts of clues about her. She's lonely, she's in debt, and there are hints of her capacity for violence. There's an incredible scene that I hope I'm not going to give away too much, involving a rotten chicken whose carcass is left for the parents to find, sort of stripped of every bit of its meat after the mother has thrown away this rotten chicken. The nanny fetches it out of the trash. But that answer, why do people snap and commit these, you know, a kind of senseless acts of violence, is never completely resolved, with to the novel's credit, I
yes.
think.
When Soleimani came over to the States after the book came out to do some events here, I talked to her about this, and she was surprised by the fact that American readers were very interested in sort of knowing what her verdict was on the characters and sort of the clear-cut answers. And she said that she thought it was so interesting that Americans, now we're going to get into gross generalizations, which always have exceptions, but that we all wanted sort of a very clean answer, much more black and white, and that she felt that in other countries, not just France, but that there was a little bit more comfort with that kind of ambiguity. And I think it was dealing with those nuances that was something that that really stood out for us when we were picking this book. All right, now we get to the two real debuts on our list. I will talk about, let's see, next we'll talk about Asymmetry by Lisa Holliday. John, you want to talk about that?
Sure. I think that this is just anecdotally, I think this was, to people I've spoken with, this was the most widely admired novel of the year. It also came out very early in the year, so we had to keep it in mind as we went. It's the story, it's kind of a triptych. The first part of the book is about a young woman named Alice, who's a 20-something publishing assistant who aspires to be a writer, and she meets in the park one day, a writer about 40 years older than her named Ezra Blazer, and they embark on an affair, a very affectionate, tender affair in which he, you know, tells her about writing. She sort of takes care of his needs as he gets older. She brings him his Mylanta, and they watch baseball in bed together. And it's patterned after, as one of our reviews said, there's an unabashed resemblance to Philip Roth and Ezra Blazer, and that's because Halliday has said that she had a brief romantic relationship with Roth. And the middle of the book completely departs. It's a first-person story told by an Iraqi-American who's been detained at Heathrow Airport on his way to visit his brother in Kurdistan. And it is essentially a first-person story about him and his family, the ways in which they suffer in the world and a lot of big political issues. And then in the third section, it's a transcript of a radio interview that the Philip Roth character gives, in which he talks about his craft and the craft of writing fiction. There are a lot of things that I really admire about this book. One is that there are about 500 ways that first section could go wrong writing about a May-December romance with someone like Philip Roth. It's incredibly subtle. It's very funny. Their dialogue is very naturalistic. It's not pretentious. She conveys a lot with a little. And the pieces don't fit together explicitly. And I think for the very small minority of readers I know who didn't greatly enjoy this book, it was because they thought, well, why are these three things all in the same book? And she leaves it up to you, I think, to connect those dots a little bit. I really care much more about the writing than the narrative structure of most books. So that it just won me over completely on the level of the prose.
It's interesting. That's one of those books that surprised us as editors at the Book Review, because we were all aware of this book. The author won a Whiting Award. We all knew it was coming, and we all knew that it was coming as sort of the book by the woman who had an affair with Philip Roth. And therefore our expectations were sort of on the low end. but it won over many, many fans at the Book Review. Greg, you were also a fan of
I really loved this book, and I did care about the structure a little bit, and I thought that the first part, the Philip Roth part, was much more successful as fiction, as kind of entering the dream, than the second part was. But I also thought that played into this idea of asymmetry, and it's an idea that she plays with throughout the book. There's personal asymmetry. He's the established writer and she's the aspiring writer. And then there's political asymmetry with America and the wars in the Middle East. And then there's this asymmetry itself in the book. So she's kind of enacting the stuff that she's writing about. And I was very impressed with how she pulled that off.
Yeah, no, me too. Yeah.
All right, our final debut.
I wanted
Tina.
To throw something in, which was that, so it was the subject of a huge auction. Like, everybody in town wanted to buy this novel when it went on the block, because her reputation was so fabulous. And it's interesting for us as editors, because we watch those auctions happen, and then 6 months or a year later, when we get the galley, you know, often were disappointed, right? I mean, but here was a case where it lived up and more. Like, it was so great to, you know,
to see that a book this good got the attention that it deserved.
Yeah, that everybody realized it at the outset, and that, you know, when it was finally in our hands, we're like...
And even though you have the kind of Philip Roth bit in the back of your head as you're reading, it really transcends that, I think.
Can I jump in just one more point?
I told you it was widely
just
admired.
To say, the three sections of the book are very different and are not explicitly connected, but one of the pleasures, if you enjoy the sort of really close reading and thinking at sort of the meta level... she drops in little clues about how these pieces connect, so that the young woman who's having the affair with Philip Roth wants to be a writer, and she's very anxious about whether she has the kind of moral vision, the ability to write a novel about the important things. And she sort of tells Ezra Blazer, you know, but what about world affairs and politics, and aren't those the important things? You know, what do I have to say? And of course, the second half of the novel is about someone who is literally in the throes of global geopolitics. He's stuck in Heathrow due to a war happening in his home country of Iraq. And the third section as well, interspersed in this sort of light-hearted radio interview, Ezra Blazer drops little comments about the novel and how sometimes you have to let characters just do what they're going to do, and they may just pass each other and not interact. Anyway, so it's really fun to kind of connect those threads. It's just, this is a brilliantly constructed
novel.
There's
something almost musical about the construction of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I think that's
true. The
little
echoes back and forth.
All right. Our final on the fiction list is There, There by Tommy Orange. Tina, you want to tell us about that?
Yes. On a very simple, like, one sentence level, this novel is about a group of Native Americans who are all traveling to a big powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. And it actually opens with this remarkable nonfiction essay. Orange is of Cheyenne and Arapaho descent, and he's making the case in this really, I mean, searing, white-hot prologue that all the ideas that, you know, the stereotypes that most Americans have about indigenous peoples, about Native Americans, are wrong. And he's talking about how, in fact, you know, they live in cities. And he says, I had to write this line down because it was so beautiful. It said, we know the sound of the freeway better than we do rivers, the howl of distant trains better than wolf howls. We know the smell of gas and freshly wet concrete better than we do the smell of cedar and sage. Anyway, I've had people just read that intro who haven't had time, you know, to sit down and read the whole book. I knew, Gal, you were also a huge fan, right?
Yeah, no, and you know, then the book moves on, right. And it's kind of this, like, kind of polyvocal portrait of, you know, Native Americans living in Oakland.
Short chapters from
short chapters, right.
Right.
And again, you know, we talked about, like, kind of what we mark, you know, as a best book. And often it's a book that, like, you know, you see the difficulty level is high. For me, a book that tries to kind of tell the story of a community, I'm like, oh, okay, let's see what happens here. And that's really what he was trying to do. But I think he really pulled it off. You know, you move from chapter to chapter and you really feel the individuals behind each of these voices. And he's doing a lot of kind of fictional pyrotechnic type things that also can go really wrong, you know, moving from third person to first person, then back to third person. I think he does it one chapter in second person, you know, but I thought it worked really well as giving kind of a sense of how these characters are trying to kind of pull out the strand of their identity that is still Native American and understand what that means for them in contemporary life.
Right. At the risk of being boring, I'm going to read one more line out loud, which was, there's one of the chapters is by a man who has a Native American father and a white mother, and he's describing how hard it is to coexist, sort of half and half in those worlds. And he says, you were white, you were brown, you were red, you were dark, you were both, and you were neither. It's just stunning writing.
There's nothing boring about that.
No.
All right, so drum roll, our five fiction winners once again are The Perfect Nanny by Leila Slimani, Lisa Holliday's Symmetry, There, There by Tommy Orange, Washington Black by Essie Adugin, and The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. Thank you.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Just so you know, the 10 best wasn't always the 10 best. It used to actually just be a random arbitrary number for a long time of which books. It could be 6 books, it could be 12 books. And when Sam Tannenhaus became the editor, he made it into a neat 10. Even then, we sometimes had an uneven number between fiction and nonfiction. I have to say we're often tempted to go back to that because we're so eager to sneak in like just one more fiction or maybe one more nonfiction. And so at the end of this, our conversation about our actual 10 best, we'll talk about some of the books that almost made it or that some of us were deep partisans of and wanted very much. So we wanted to honor those books as well. But before we get into the sort of personal runners-ups, the nonfiction winners, let's start with our first book, which is Shane Bower's American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. Emily, you want to start?
Sure. So American Prison is really a remarkable feat of investigative reporting. Shane Bower is a name many of you might know. He probably first came to public attention when he was arrested with two friends for trespassing into Iranian soil and spent 2 years in an Iranian jail. And upon returning to the United States after he was released, he, as a reporter for Mother Jones, hired himself to work as a corrections officer in a private prison. He decided to go undercover, sort of, although he worked under his own name. He wanted to learn about the private prison industry in this country, which is substantial. Something like 8% of American inmates are held in prisons that are privately run. And he was hired, as I say, with very little due diligence. They didn't figure out he was a reporter, and he went undercover, armed with all sorts of equipment to sort of record and photograph his experience there. And his stint lasted 4 months before he was sort of caught. His identity was revealed. But that was plenty. He was working at a private prison in rural Louisiana, and what he saw was shocking.
Very little training going in also.
Right. Extremely poor training, very low morale, very low pay, medical negligence, just violence, incompetence. Bloodhounds were used on inmates. There was a suicide that he was present at the prison when it happened. And all of this he wrote up initially in an article for Mother Jones that won a National Magazine Award. And he's expanded that article into a book and added some of the most disturbing details, actually the historical research that he did for the book, where he uncovers the model for the private prison industry dates to the South after the Civil War, when majority black inmates were sort of farmed out to plantations to pick cotton in a form of slave labor. This was a practice known as convict leasing. And this allowed the South to remain competitive with the industrial North North. Basically, they had a kind of captive workforce. I think the biggest cotton mill in Texas at one point was in a prison in Texas. So it's a very disturbing expose, very powerful reporting.
I mean, one of the achievements of this book is something that's hard to pull off, which is so many books begin as articles, as magazine articles or newspaper stories, and don't ever really transcend that kind of form. You sort of feel like you're getting an expanded article, or it should have stayed in that format. And I think this is an example of a book that really manages to make a case for the book itself and to really offer more context and depth so that it stands on its own.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I found this book so searing and so shocking. I actually went back to a book that was a huge hit 25 years ago called New Jack. Do you remember that?
Yes.
About someone trained to
the
work
Ted Conover.
The Ted Conover. He was well compensated. He was well trained. I mean, it could not have been
the
more
starker,
opposite.
The differences.
Right.
Yeah. He did not work at a private prison.
No, he didn't. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, just the, it was, it, you know.
The Shane Bauer, too, is a book that fans of Jesmyn Ward's Sing Unburied Sing might turn to for background, because there's a lot of the over. That's also a Louisiana prison, and it gives kind of the nonfiction version of the prison stuff in her story.
One of the hardest things about choosing our five best nonfiction is that there are so many different kinds of books to cover, from investigative reporting to finance and economics to science to memoir. It's to history. And biography. It's just so many different options. It's very, very tough to narrow down. And the next book on our list, I think, is one that occupies several categories. It's the Michael Pollan, How to Change Your Mind. And this book, you could say, is a science book, but it's also a history of the psychedelics in this country and the culture around it. And it's also really a book about the brain and I think, frankly, just a book about what it means to be human. This was a book that the publisher actually held a lunch for the media, as they occasionally do. And at this media lunch, which was filled with reporters and jaded media types and editors at book reviews like ours, everyone was sort of transfixed and just listened as Michael Pollan told a story about how, in order to report this book on psychedelics, he needed, he felt, to take psychedelics himself. And he had not ever taken LSD. He ended up, I think, trying four or five different psychedelics himself. And at the end of the conversation, the first question that someone asked was, can you tell us a little bit more about the underground networks through which you obtained these drugs? And it was like they had articulated what everyone else in the room was thinking. And we kept him there, I think, for, you know, another hour asking him questions.
They didn't hand it out at the lunch. That wasn't part of the lunch.
You know, and Michael Pollan is no newcomer to nonfiction. He's obviously a huge best-selling writer. He writes for the New York Times Magazine and many other places. And this piece, I think, rose out of a piece for the New York. But we all felt that this book, in a way, and Emily, maybe you could talk about this after too, it's almost as if his writing went to another level after. I'm not going to necessarily attribute it to the drugs, but it you know, we all love what he did in books like The Botany of Desire and all of his books on sort of how and why we should eat certain foods. This book, it almost seemed like he was transformed by the writing. And I have to say, as someone who came to this book with a completely closed mind about psychedelics, and for the record, I've not ever taken acid, I walked away feeling almost evangelical, as other editors on this on the stage here know well.
I think what's like, for me, the most interesting part of the book is when he gets into this kind of spiritual notion of what psychedelics actually do, which is they strips away kind of the ego part of our brains and allows us to reconnect with a kind of a childlike, you know, approach to the world. And he's trying to understand kind of what that means for how we can like be happy, happier, and live as kind of conscious people.
Yeah, I don't know about the writing being transformed, but I think he was somewhat transformed. Yeah. And says that in the book. I mean, he admits early on in the book that he's a very square guy.
Yeah.
And he's very convincing about that. And he says that he's not a very spiritual guy, that he doesn't do a lot of self-reflection. And what he and a lot of other people in the book who he talks to who have taken LSD really talk about is the way in which after the trip. It's not really like the grooviness of looking at all the colors and this and that, but they want to almost maintain this sense of perspective that they got while they were gone.
Right.
And they want to apply it to their, it's almost like therapy. Mm-hmm. And his big argument in the book, it is a lot of everything, science, memoir, history. But if there's an argument to it, it's that he's saying that science is only now kind of getting back to the job of trying to rescue the use of LSD as a possible therapeutic practice and to get it back from what he calls the countercultural baggage. Because what happened is Timothy Leary and everyone in the 60s, it just got associated with this zany sort of escapist culture. And he's saying that even back then, scientists were starting to think about how it might help people.
And there's a lot that's convincing about how it helps PTSD and people who are, you know, having terminal illness at the end of their lives. And
And one of the things I loved about it is it is so much more than just science and medicine. I mean, it goes back way before Ken Kesey. I mean, your hero, William James, figures really prominently in this. I mean, Aldous Huxley. And so there's literary implications and, Steve Jobs took it. I mean, so there's, it's really big in the tech community and sort of how the dissolution of the ego pervades just, sort of medical questions it was just a...
All right, speaking of Steve Jobs, our third book is Lisa Brennan Jobs' memoir, Small Fry. This was a book, again, that I think took us all by surprise. We all knew it was coming, and we knew it was coming with the line that I think most people thought about this book as the memoir by Steve Jobs' daughter. And I think that all of us found that it was so much more than that. Tina, you want to tell us about reading Small Fry?
I do. And my favorite line, again, I'm sorry to do this, will sort of encapsulate it. She says of her father, "For him, I was the blot on a spectacular ascent." And, at the beginning of the book, she's his oldest child, by the way. Her mother is suing for child support, and because he's denied paternity. He's forced to take a paternity test. It's proven that he's the father. Her mother wins $500 a month in support. Meanwhile, Apple is about to go, am I getting this language right? Go public, Emily? Yes. And like the day after the agreement, and he knew this was coming, he was worth $220 million all of a sudden.
But people know nothing about money.
Yeah.
I was going to say, with Apple, I don't think it was go public. It was go interstellar. I think that was the...
What? Oh, interesting. Anyway, so her story, and it's her story. It's not her father's story. I think a lot of people have come to this book thinking that it's going to be more about Steve Jobs. It's not. It's about the neglect and abuse, indeed, that she suffered at the hands of her father. But more than that, it's a book about how our parents shape us.
Yes, I guess I too, I think we were all struck by the prose. And I will say there was a lot of skepticism, not just in the office, but among even potential reviewers who said, oh, this had to be ghost written.
She is Mona Simpson's niece.
Right.
or score settling.
And I know Lisa herself has said, I believe on our podcast, that this was not the book she wanted to write as a first book. She really did not want to write the story of her life and her father. Anything but that, she said. Something like to that effect.
She said, it's the book I needed to write to get it out of the way, which I thought was such a beautiful description for
she couldn't avoid writing this book. Yeah. And I think that when you read it, you will see how vindicated she is. She really is a writer. This is a book that works on the kind of accretion of granular detail. There's just, it's an assembly of vignettes and scenes that are painted with just such vivid and subtle detail that it's extraordinary. I'm thinking of one scene. She's driving with her mother through the rain, and her mother's really losing it. Her mother is an impoverished single parent and a struggling artist in a beat-up car. One of the windshield wipers doesn't work very well. There's a pit where a stone has hit the windshield, and Lisa's taking all of this in the front seat next to her mother. Her mother begins to wail and scream and beat her fists on the steering wheel in the driving rain. And Lisa is 4. And I think she discussed this scene on our podcast, and she says she remembers it vividly. And, she was 4. You're with her. You believe her. The accretion of detail is just extraordinary.
I want to hear a little more from Lauren, because I think she's the one who joked at one point during this process in the office. She said, can all 5 nonfiction books be Small Fry?
It just goes back to what Pamela was saying about, and Gall too, about sort of the criteria that goes into this decision, which is, the merit and the difficulty of the task that they set out for, these authors set out for themselves. And I think, we all have read and seen and just heard about this ultra narrative of Steve Jobs. This is not a person we don't come into the book without preconceptions. And for this debut, very young author to come in and sort of topple, I think, this narrative by heavyweights like Walter Isaacson and was it Sorkin who did the movie? I mean, these big names who are telling this story and feeding us this story of Steve Jobs, and no one doubts his genius and his contribution to contemporary life. But there's another narrative that's really important, and if you want to get the story of the whole person, I think that it really meaningfully informs sort of history and just your understanding of human interaction, and it was a stunner to me.
And Lauren, you also made the point that it's as much about her mother and about the relationship between mother and
daughter. It's a mother-daughter story as well.
All right, our next nonfiction winner is another memoir, another debut. This was one that we agreed on, I think, very early on. There was a lot of consensus around Tara Westover's Educated. John, you want to start a little bit on that book?
I'll start. This is just one of those books where the story itself is so incredible that she's a great writer, and she's also really good at granular detail and scenes, like Emily was saying about Lisa Brennan Jobs. But just this story, and I'll let others fill in more of the details, of going basically from living with a separatist father who believes that society is poisonous, and being raised in this almost medieval way, and being illiterate for a very long time, and then eventually becoming, I forgot where she got her PhD from, but
Cambridge.
From Cambridge, is just the outline of it. Even if this was only passably written, it would be an incredible book to read, but it's better than that.
Yeah, I feel like it's people hearing about this book sometimes are quick to lump it into what I call the misery memoir category, but it's anything but. And she was entirely self-taught. Being homeschooled for their family meant that the mom would send them down in the basement and they would just turn the pages of books. Doing 50 pages of math meant opening the math book and just turning 50 pages. And her, whatever it was in her that made her want more and made her want to learn and to educate herself, I mean, she... this is somebody who never went to high school. She had to study for the college entrance exams on her own.
I felt like her relentless curiosity and sort of pursuit of self-knowledge pervades the book itself, in that she not only wrote her own story, but then she had a number of siblings, some of whom she's not on good terms with, others whom she is, the reasons become obvious in the telling of the story. But she goes back and asks them about their memories of certain experiences and sort of checks her against herself against their accounts, which I thought was an interesting and brave thing to do in a memoir.
I would urge people to go back to the original podcast that she appeared on when the book came out, because that was a really great conversation you had with her, where she talked about that and a lot of other things that really showed her like the depth and range of her emotional intelligence.
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting is, so having basically educated herself, she's not widely read in memoirs. Do you know how when you sometimes read a memoir, you have the sense that somebody has, been reading from Mary Carr on? But her voice is just so original. This isn't constructed like a regular memoir.
All right, I'm going to, without further ado, go to our last book on the list, which is David W. Blight's Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, a monumental biography that was just recently published. Gall, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So Blight is a Yale professor whose expertise is the abolition movement. And here again, it's a different kind of difficulty level, in that Frederick Douglass himself has wrote so much about his own life.
Three memoirs.
What was that?
Three autobiographies.
Three autobiographies, yes. Like nearly 1,000 pages, I think, about his own life. And so how do you approach the story of Frederick Douglass and bring freshness to it? So Blight had access to archives that weren't really used before, a private collection that he was able to get his hands on. And what he does with that material is really deepen the story in two ways. First, you get the personal life of Frederick Douglass, which is kind of underneath the surface of the memoirs. It doesn't really break through. You know, for example, the story of his lovers, the story of his second wife, a woman who was white. It's kind of an unusual circumstance, you know, in the late 19th century. So you get really a story of his household in Rochester and this kind of strange arrangements and the chaos that surrounded it. And also you get his later life, once he'd also become truly a celebrity in America. And a sense, I think, and this came through in our review of the book, of just his natural charisma, mm-hmm. just a man who really was able to kind of claim an audience when he stood in front of people. And I think that it all just comes through in a really kind of magisterial way in this book.
It's also, you know, he's one of those figures that we think we all know right. What we need to know about, you know, in terms of his career as an abolitionist and his speeches and his own writing. And what Blight makes clear by contextualizing it in the history of the time is just how exceptional every step of his life was, from the circumstances of his own slavery. And he really gets into detail that I found fascinating, the fact that when he was a slave in Baltimore, that he lived among free men, which is not our conception of how slaves were housed and how they went about their daily lives, and the circumstances of his escape and the way in which he was able to rise from prominence from absolutely nothing. Almost every step of the way, his life was marked by things that were exceptions to the history of that moment.
And his role, I mean, also just the influence that he had over American society at the time, which seems unusual to read about now, you know, to think that Abraham Lincoln called him to the White House to kind of help him deal with issues surrounding the Civil War.
It's almost like it reminded me of Ron Chernow's Hamilton in that way. And right. that sort of,
we've been saying Lin-Manuel Miranda needs to get this book.
That's right. All right. You've heard it here first. Okay. Our five nonfiction winners, just to go over them quickly again: American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment by Shane Bauer, Educated, a Memoir by Tara Westover, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence by Michael Pollan, and Small Fry by Lisa Brennan Jobs. Okay, and now to talk a little bit about some of those that didn't make our list but that we truly loved. I'm going to start with Lauren.
Okay, one of my favorite books of the year was actually a debut short story collection called Friday Black by Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. They're satirical stories, so there's humor in them, but they're really all about violence and violence in America, and of really two kinds, racially motivated violence and the violence of consumerism, which, you know, obviously there are breaks between each story, but you really can't help but draw the connections between, you know, obviously Friday Black is an inversion of Black Friday, so the consumerism as well as, you know, racial violence. I think, you know, we were all really taken with one of the stories called The Finkelstein Five, in which the narrator... So the backdrop of the story is a white man is on trial for murdering five black children with a chainsaw. And so it's really sort of hyperbolic violence, but the references are undeniable and really obvious, just to real life. And, you know, I won't give away what happens, but so that's in the backstory. And the narrator, who is a black man, is witnessing all this and has to deal with, you know, sort of his community grappling with the stakes of this trial. At the same time, you know, he's going about his daily life, interviewing for jobs, and he dials up and down his capital B blackness on a scale of 1 to 10. So, you know, he'll say in this interview, he's, you know, lower down on the scale. And, you know, when he's experiencing frustration and rage, he's much higher up on the scale. And it's just such a brilliant narrative device because as a reader, you know, you obviously don't have an image of him, but the image in your head, you can't help but change your image in your head when you get, you know, from number to number. And it just makes you sort of examine your own conscious or unconscious biases. And I just think as a narrative tool, it was such a powerful book for me. It's rough around the edges. It just, you know, it's not a perfect book, but, you know, I think that had to have been intentional. I think the subject matter is so messy and ugly that, you know, it's impossible to tie up with a neat bow. And I just thought that was next, just the next
All
one.
Right. We should say it's written by a 27-year-old debut author, and so that's understandable. One of the great pleasures of working with Tina Jordan is her enthusiasm. When she loves a book, she can also be extremely critical and judgmental too.
Yes,
but when she loves a book, she comes in raving about it. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about Rachel Slade?
So Rachel Slade's book, Into the Raging Sea, is the kind of narrative nonfiction that I love. It's what we in the journalism world call a TikTok. It's a story that just goes moment by moment and takes you through a disaster. The disaster in this case is the sinking of a cargo ship during Hurricane Joaquin in 2015. And what Slade did to reconstruct this disaster moment by moment was she had the black box. She transcribed the black box. She had text messages and email messages, you know, that members of the crew were sending to their friends and family. You know, she had taped phone messages that they had left on people's phones and answering machines. It's almost as if it ushered in a new way to do this kind of nonfiction. You made me realize that the very idea of what's considered a primary source in nonfiction has changed in this day and age. You know, when you read a book like Sebastian Younger's The Perfect Storm, obviously, you know, a lot of that is imagined, that dialogue. But in this book, it's all real. And I just couldn't put it down.
All right, for something that a book that is kind of unreal in all respects, Emily, can you tell us about one of your runners-up? This was a book that we were talking about for months.
There were a lot of so many good books this year, but I wanted to talk about My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Moshfegh, because I don't think anyone here would disagree. It was the book that provoked the most conversation, the most heated conversation in the office. There was a lot of disagreement about what this book was trying to do and how well it succeeded. It was a very interesting experience reading this book. Otessa Moshfegh, I believe, has published, this is, I think, her third novel. All of her books, all three of them, are provocative. Her characters tend to have unattractive traits. She tends to foreground bodily functions and disgusting things. And this book was a very unpleasant read for me, I have to confess. And I found it very interesting because the prose struck me aesthetically as very, very beautiful and controlled and very deliberate. And what I think she was up to in this book, very quickly to sketch it, it's about an unnamed, young, beautiful female protagonist, a college graduate, whose parents have died and left her enough money to live on. Her ambition is sapped. She can't feel any sadness for her parents. She doesn't feel much of anything. She says, I feel nothing. Her parents weren't attractive people. She's not an attractive person. She has one friend whom she belittles and disparages behind her back, a boyfriend that sort of uses her and has really basically dumped her. Not a very attractive person. And she's decided that the way to address her sort of spiritual apathy is to sleep for a year. What would happen if she could just hibernate? And she finds a psychiatrist who is one of the great satirical psychiatrists in contemporary literature, hilariously terrible psychiatrist who plies her with all kinds of medications and says things like, how are you feeling? Oh, well, I'm thinking, I think I'm overthinking. Oh, that's not good. That could lead to psychosis. You need some, and we'll hand her another prescription. And soon this woman is sleeping. Basically, through the novel, she sleeps. And that's a very interesting thing, right? It's very boring to think about reading a novel about a woman who's asleep. But all kinds of things happen when she's asleep. She wakes up every once in a while and discovers she's been to Saks Fifth Avenue and bought a fur coat. Or, you know, she's eaten, you know, three takeout containers of Chinese food or rented three movies. So a lot's going on while she's asleep. And not to drone on too long, I'm very struck by this book. I think it was a very original, really allegorical book about the kind of anesthetized state of our society and consumer culture, to sound very pretentious. And, you know, others may chime in and disagree, but it was an original and heady read for me.
All right. I want to get everyone, give everyone a chance to talk up at least one favorite. Gal, can you tell us about Rise and Kill first?
Sure. So this is a book by Ronen Bergman, who's an Israeli journalist, who's the book is written in English. And he basically wanted to tell the entire story of Israel's use of kind of assassination as a method of kind of security. And he goes back to the birth of the state of Israel and tracks it all the way until today. It's an interesting narrative because there's no kind of like the only through line is this method of deciding that you need to kind of take down your enemy before he's able to take you down. And you know, there is kind of a sense of justification about this as far as the Israeli state is concerned, because there is always a sense of kind of existential crisis that there are enemies who want to destroy us. And so we need to destroy them first. But what's interesting that happens as you kind of move through the narrative and get to today is that, you know, the ability to do these sorts of assassinations with like drones, you know, becomes so much easier that the kind of moral balance starts to tip. And you know, without kind of a too heavy a hand, Bergman kind of forces us to ask questions about, you know, when you can do that, when you can kill so easily, you know, what kind of, does it become ultimately counterproductive? Are you creating more terror?
I think one of the things that was so impressive about this book was the extent of the reporting and the number of people he spoke to. And my favorite line is when he calls up someone within the security forces or the intelligence in Israel, and the person basically says to him, "I hate you, and I hate whoever gave you my phone number," and sort of hangs this up on him. So he's a tenacious reporter. John, tell us about, you had two here very quickly.
I'll go quickly, the lightning round. My fiction pick is Sigrid Nunez's The Friend, which won the National Book Award a couple of weeks ago, and which I revisited this week, I read a while back, and which I liked even more kind of flipping through it the second time. It's the story of a woman who inherits a Great Dane from a friend of hers, a writer friend of hers who's committed suicide, and it's a very aphoristic book. It draws on a lot of old stories about other writers and their thoughts about living and friendship and writing. It's very explicitly about writing and the art of writing. It's also very explicitly about how to live and whether or not to live. But it also just wears its profundity very lightly. And it's a fairly small book, and I would highly recommend probably get through it in a couple of hours.
Not small book.
The nonfiction book I have not finished and may never. It's about 8,000 pages long, and it's called and it's about the 15th century. All this sounds like the opposite of accessible, but it's I hate the word readable because you know, they're words, so it's like people call a beer drinkable, you know? I would hope it's a liquid, so it's, of course. But it does apply in this case because it's a book about Martin Luther and Erasmus and their two philosophies during the Renaissance and basically Christian humanism versus Christian evangelicalism, and how those two, they really started us down that forked path, and how Erasmus has kind of, the humanist part, has kind of fallen by the wayside and Luther has been victorious. Michael Massing, the author, is a journalist, and it's just very well-chosen details. It reads just beautifully, and you can kind of move through it chapter by chapter in a way that feels very doable, even though sitting on your desk it looks impossible.
All right, for those who want to do that, the title is
Fatal Discord.
Okay.
By Michael Massing.
All right, Greg, you have two also on your list.
Yeah, one fiction, one non, and I'll also be quick. The novel that has really stuck with me in a way that I didn't initially anticipate was The Overstory by Richard Powers. Powers often writes about scientist characters, and he does again in this book. One of the main characters is a dendrologist who studies neural networks, and she discovers that trees communicate through the roots, and in fact, they really do. But it's a much bigger book than that. And over the course of the book, I talked in about asymmetry, how I like structure and architecture in novels. And this is a book that is really about the trees themselves. There's a Vietnam vet character and a group of eco-terrorists who all come together with the scientists to try to save a stand of old trees in the Pacific Northwest. And it's a book that, in focusing on these trees, it takes you outside of the human time scale and into a bigger time scale than we're used to thinking about in our lives, certainly in fiction. And it's a book that during the California wildfires, I really couldn't get out of my mind in terms of how we treat the natural world and how important it is to us that, you know, we're so focused on kind of our intimate personal lives, but there's this bigger thing beyond us that he really captures in a way that that I admired very much. And he's a beautiful writer. And it's a book that balances the human and the natural. And then in nonfiction, a book that has overlaps in some ways with Small Fry. It's a memoir, again, very intimate, about a relationship with a mother, is the book Heavy by a guy named Kiese Layman, who it's his first memoir, but I think his third book. He's done an essay collection and a novel. And it is, he grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, with a mother who is very demanding. He's Black, growing up in Mississippi, and she was very demanding at trying to get him to succeed and study. She would give him extracurricular school assignments, papers, reading assignments. And I mean, she was demanding to the point of abuse. She would really beat him and then hide the beatings so that it wouldn't reflect badly on the family. And he did succeed, and he loves his mother a lot, but there's a lot, it's a very fraught relationship, and it takes place against this backdrop of racism and gambling and eating and sex, and, you know, there's just a lot going on there, and it's a very wide-eyed, I mean, clear-eyed, unflinching portrait that I just really recommend.
Pamela, what about you?
All right, I will end with two books that I think we sometimes don't recognize enough because they are pleasurable to read, both of them. One fiction, one nonfiction. The fiction is Tana French's The Witch Elm, which Tana French is just such an amazing writer, and this is a standalone novel, not one of her Dublin Murder Squad mysteries. But one that, and it's hard to talk about it without revealing anything about the plot, but I will say this, when you do get to the end and you know who did what and why, it's a book that really is actually very much about our current moment in ways that are surprising and I found different for French. And so and also just a lot of fun to read. And then in that same vein, David Sedaris's Calypso. We were all such fans here of that book. Everyone you know, knows David Sedaris, and he makes writing that is easy to read look easy to write. And I don't think that it is. I think that his writing, I think, reflects a kind of constant fine tuning of his craft. And this book, I thought, I mean, all his books are great, but I found this one to be especially moving and touching. I thought he went deeper and looked at some of the things that he touched, perhaps on a more lightly humorous level in previous work, he went back to and kind of examined and looked at more deeply. So those were two that I enjoyed reading. But with that, I think we should we'll end our live portion of the Book Review podcast. Thank you to all of my panelists. It's such a pleasure to work with such talented and eloquent editors and writers here at the Book Review: Gal Beckerman, Emily Aiken, Tina Jordan, Greg Coles, Lauren Christensen, and John Williams. Thank you all so much. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, albeit not right away. The Book Review podcast is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with the great help of my colleague, John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.